Good afternoon. It is 12:02. It's Eric Scott here on a Friday afternoon. Got some sunshine today, and of course, our regular guest, Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, of course, a Wolfboro resident, and also Bernie DeShays is here with us as well. Senator, good afternoon.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
I am very well, sir.
Been a while?
Yes, it has. No Mount Washington Commission meeting today?
Not today, no. I think it's May 20th that we have our next one, so I'll probably have to do a short show that day, too.
That's okay. We'll make it work. So how's everything going so far? Were you in session yesterday?
We had a long day, but we were in session, and I think next Thursday we're in session again, but so's Brody.
And how was your session, Senator? Had some good luck with some of the bills that you've been working on?
Yeah, I mean, there's always the give and take between the House and the Senate and the governor, but I think we're making progress. Something that we've talked about a lot on the show that Brody has been extraordinarily helpful with, our efforts to fix our bail system and so-called fixes to bail reform. We passed it again yesterday, and it's on a House bill now. We took out one piece that, you know, the police chiefs wanted, but, you know, some members of the House couldn't get that far to vote for it. And hopefully that'll help us get the necessary votes that we need to pass this bill in the House.
Great. Okay. Brody, how you doing?
I'm doing well, and as Senator Bradley mentioned, we are working hard on bail reform. I've probably called well over 40 Democrats now. I'm trying to ask them to support a floor amendment that mirrors the amendment they introduced in the Senate for House Bill 1476. And the ultimate goal of it will make it so then violent criminals who committed a violent crime with a victim, well, instead of going in front of a bail commissioner, they'll go in front of a judge, and a judge has a lot more latitude and powers of setting specific conditions for bail that can make communities and victims safer. So, I mean, we're working really hard on it. I'm very confident about the floor amendment. It's going to be introduced by the chairman, the Republican chairman of the Criminal Justice Committee, Daryl Abbas, and we're hoping if we can get that floor amendment passed that we'll have enough Democrats from, you know, cities like Manchester, Dover, Nashua, that they'll cross the aisle understanding that, you know, while we're trying not to throw the baby out with the bathwater with the current bail reform, we recognize that there's some shortcomings to it, specifically regarding the victims of violent crime and how they're considered in this whole process, and trying to make it so then we can keep our communities safer. We don't want to see any more stories where someone has committed a violent crime and then within 48 hours commits the same violent crime against the same victim. So
it does happen. Unfortunately, it happens far too often. But you got to admit, in terms of the number of people, it's not that many people.
It's not that many, but it doesn't, you know, we act as if, you know, as if that one event, that one crime that happens, that only one person is affected. But there's trauma felt by the entire family. So, mm-hmm. I mean, not only does the victim go through, you know, irreparable kind of harm, and you know, their life can be completely altered, but family members, you know, their lives can be completely altered and everything, and especially if it's something like a domestic violence misdemeanor, which would be something included in this floor amendment, what is was included in what the senator amended the House bill to. Those are very traumatic situations, and it can have a profound effect on, you know, more than just one individual, up to even 10 individuals depending on how big your family is. And so, you know, it makes more sense for situations like that for a bail hearing to be in front of a judge and for the judge to be able to set specific conditions to keep those victims safe after a violent crime has been committed, and even more to keep the community safe, right, to force someone to go to anger management counseling, or if it was a drug issue, to force them to enter into rehab. Bail commissioners don't have those powers. Another thing, too, is our bail commissioners aren't always well-trained in every part of the state. So sometimes they don't realize what kind of powers they have, or, you know, it can be a struggle to set the PR bail for them. So We're trying to make it so that our justice system is more just to everyone, and we have to consider the people who are on the receiving end of these crimes, and we have to consider the safety of the community, because at the end of the day, if you can't walk safely in your community, you know, it's impossible for you to practice your individual liberties and your rights in the public public square.
Right. All right. Thanks, Brody. I appreciate it. As we continue on a little bit, I wanted to talk to you about that, about bail for what so-called victimless crimes, Senator, if you're still with me.
Yep.
Should there be a, I'm not sure if the exception is the rule, but something that is supposedly victimless, betting on a football game, or marijuana or prostitution, something that's relatively, like I said, victimless crime. There'll still be bail for things like that, nonviolent things, correct?
So what did this bill of mine that, you know, I think Brody did a really good job explaining, it just is 12 violent crimes, okay? Murder, manslaughter, rape, sexual assault, domestic violence, and then, you know, child pornography is one which, you know, I think most people would say that's pretty horrific. Kidnapping. So those are the crimes that are cited in this proposed law that would mean you'd have to go before a judge as opposed to a bail commissioner. So it's meant to be a surgical fix to what was done a few years ago, to make sure that, you know, A, we're protecting victims, and B, people that are a risk of offending in a violent manner because they've already been accused of a violent crime have to see a judge to be determined they're not a risk to society at large. That's the issue, but it's narrow, and it's staggering to me that you know, so many people are siding with, you know, violent criminals as opposed to victims, and, you know, it's unfortunately there are a handful of Republicans that have taken this stand, and virtually all Democrats in the House. In the Senate, there's been bipartisan support. I mean, yesterday the vote was 21-3. I still can't believe the three people voted against it because there's just been so much evidence of problems in New Hampshire of people that, you know, were apprehended, accused of a violent crime, released, and then went out and hours later, you know, recommitted a violent crime. I will say our problem in New Hampshire has not been as bad as in other states where it's been a revolving door. That being said, we're the safest state in the nation, and there are reasons why we're the safest state in the nation. And having good laws and properly enforced is part of that reason. Well, we've got a problem in bail, and it needs to be fixed because people deserve to be safe in their homes, on the streets, in schools, wherever. So
what are some of the what are some of the reasons people give you that are not backing this bill?
I think that, you know, there's been a move away from my dog is barking. I apologize to all your listeners.
That's okay.
There.
We like dogs.
I'm going to give him a cookie and hopefully...
Usually it's my cat meowing.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, 10 years ago in the Me Too movement, and there was just so much emphasis, rightfully so, on protecting victims. But for whatever reason, we've moved away from that. And I think it's unfortunate. Violent crime is on the rise around the country. As a result, we saw, you know, all the riots of the summer of 2020. And, you know, there's just not the same ethic, it would appear, in a lot of places to protect victims. And I think both Brody and I are saying enough. We're on the side of victims. And I know the public's with us.
Right. On that subject, the Biden administration nationally looking to roll back some of the Trump area regulations about immigration. Is rolling back these rules a good idea?
Absolutely not. I mean, look, the Title 42, I mean, look, we have lost operational control of the border right now. You see it on your TV. The statistics show it. The number of illegal border crossings, you know, when President Trump left office, were at record lows over the last 20 or 30 years. Now we are setting record highs. And if Title 42 goes away, which allows, you know, some people to be returned that are COVID risks, if that goes away, we're going to have a flood. I mean, we already have a flood. The flood's just going to get higher. And even Democrats now are starting to say to the Biden administration, enough already. But, you know, they're tone deaf. And they're willfully allowing hundreds of thousands, millions, really, of illegals to cross the border. And I mean, the, you know, 42 people on the terrorist watch list are documented to have gotten into this country. So, I mean, it's not just a question of people coming here looking for opportunity or they're fleeing their home country to seek asylum. I mean, we're seeing fentanyl coming across the border, which is deadly. We're in the middle of a drug epidemic still in this country. It's unimaginable that the rule of law has been so discarded by the Biden administration. I'm all for legal immigration, but there has to be a system in place for people to be able to come here legally. I think we should be open to having people be able to, you know, come here to seek economic opportunity, but they need to be vetted and screened and, you know, not become a burden to the system once they get to the United States. And there are ways to do it, but boy, this isn't one of them. And again, you know, just like crime, just like inflation, border security is really an issue that I think, you know, is leading to very, very low poll ratings for the Biden administration.
Brody, you would want to chip in?
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe the political stunt committed by, you know, Senator Hass and Congressman Pappas. Just, you know, they've supported these open border policies now for, you know, their entire political careers, and all of a sudden election season's coming around the corner. They really see how difficult it's going to be. And they're going down, committing stunts, acting like they haven't supported a lot of the Biden administration, the Obama administration's policies, and opposed the Trump administration's policies to ensure that, you know, our border was much more secure under the Trump administration. Under the Biden and the Obama administrations, it hasn't been. And, you know, we need to have a border. We need to have security. We need to be able to know who's coming in and out of this country. It's, you know, every country does that around the world. And to think that America shouldn't, you know, have its own is the same thing. And, you know, I'd just like to thank Senator Bradley in the Senate for opposing House Bill 579, which I don't know how it passed the House with such an overwhelming majority, which would make it so then the border security agents would have to publish online that they're setting up a border security checkpoint. Even though they've already gotten a warrant, they'd have to tell everyone that they're setting up a border security checkpoint anywhere in the state of New Hampshire.
It's the stupidest thing I ever heard.
It is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And I couldn't believe there was only about less than 100 people, you know, in all Republicans, less than 100 Republicans, myself and Representative McDonald included, that actually opposed the bill, because it makes no sense. You're going to tell every single person who's human trafficking, who is trafficking drugs, who has illegally entered into the country, that, oh, we're setting up a checkpoint to try and find you committing a crime, committing a federal offense. And, you know what I mean? And I couldn't believe the argument that some of my colleagues made, whether it was in my party or the opposing caucus, that, oh, well, this is what we do for drunk driving checkpoints. We require people to you know, make a public announcement and to post it online and to make an announcement. To me, that seems, I was like, I was talking to folks. I was like, it seems more like that's broken. You're going to tell every single person who's drunk driving in a specific area that we're trying to set up a drunk driving checkpoint, you know, a sobriety checkpoint, that, you know, that they're going to be checking that day. So drive a different way when you're drunk driving. If law enforcement gets a warrant, right, where they're allowed to search in a specific area to make sure that a crime isn't being committed, that's the constitutional way of doing it. And the fact that we're going to be telling criminals or to be telling people who are trafficking children that the government is going to be in a specific place at a specific time, so don't go there, it was the most absurd proposal I had seen. And I was, I just couldn't believe it. I'm just very happy that the Senate Republicans, you know, led by Senator Bradley and, Senate President Chuck Morris, who's now running against Maggie Hassan, that they stood up and they said, we can't have these open borders and we need to have law enforcement. We need to have ICE in our border security and Homeland Security enforcing our laws. They're on the books. We shouldn't be telling people how to evade those laws.
Because currently, if I remember right, they can set up within 100 miles of the border.
Yeah, which means New Hampshire, correct? I mean, a border checkpoint, you know, can be set up anywhere in New Hampshire. And I had someone who they thought they were being cheeky who said, you know, so what happens if they set up a border checkpoint in downtown Wolfboro on 4th of July? And I couldn't believe that was going to be that. That's how they thought they were going to sway my vote. I just said, well, you know, they already set up sobriety checkpoints in our area of New Hampshire. They have them all over the Lakes region, and they know not to do them on 4th of July, and sometimes they do them in some areas of the Lakes region on 4th of July, but that's part of preventing drunk drivers from being on the road. It's part of preventing people from, again, you know, trafficking children or sex trafficking in general, from, you know, trafficking drugs. It's part of how, it's a tool our law enforcement uses to protect our communities. And to think that, you know, that a Republican majority was going to send that bill to Chris Sununu to basically tell everyone, oh, you know, here's where law enforcement's going to be to help enforce our laws on the book, you know, drive this way to evade them. I shook my head and I couldn't believe it. You know, my jaw dropped when I saw that roll call. And when I saw how overwhelmingly the House passed that, I mean, you know, one of those moments where you say, thank God for the senior body, the Senate, be able to stop us from ruining good things. So
I assume.
Yeah, I was shocked too, actually. I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, we have sobriety checkpoints for a reason. They're not there to harass people. They're there to keep, you know, the roads safe. And I'm not sure it's a good idea to publish sobriety checkpoints. But, you know, at least you can make the argument, if you support that, you know, notification for sobriety checkpoints, that you're dealing with citizens, okay? Immigration checkpoints, you're trying to apprehend people that are crossing the border illegally. And there are drugs coming across the northern border, to say nothing of people that don't belong in this country. So publishing that and giving people an easy opportunity to evade, I'm sorry, that's ridiculous. And I mean, I guess it's ridiculous. It's not ridiculous. I mean, if you believe in open borders and that borders don't matter and that you don't care if our national security is undermined, that, you know, we're letting drugs in across the border, terrorists or what have you. If you want all of that, then don't secure the borders. But I think this is a reason why people that are advocating for those policies are not going to do too well in the fall election.
Out of curiosity, I've noticed that a lot of countries have very strict border policies, China being one of them. Even Canada is relatively strict on
Canada,
their borders.
I mean,
right.
France, you have to become a French citizen is nearly impossible. You have to be like ethnically French, you know. Sorry, Senator Bradley. You know, I'd have an easier time as a French Canadian, but it's like, you know, America's a very welcoming place, right? And our border security is lacking, and we need to improve it. But then again, you know, our process for citizenship isn't that complex. And is it a little bit bogged down? Could you use some updates? Yeah, probably. But we could also update our border security, and that should be more paramount. But in America, anyone who goes through the legal process can become a citizen and an extremely, you know, viable member of the body politic, you know, involved in our civics, and very, you know, an important economic asset to the entire community. And, you know, I don't think Republicans are asking a lot to say, listen, let's enforce our border laws that are already on the books. Let's, you know, let's keep working to improve our border security. Let's finish the wall. And, you know, let's even consider, you know, different ways that we can update our immigration processing and the processing of citizenship, so then we can get, you know, great workers and great, you know, people who want to participate in the American dream. I mean, look, the whole concept of the wall, you know, Donald Trump wasn't the first one who came up with it. Actually, when Barack Hussein Obama, President Obama, when he was Senator Obama, he brought forward an amendment to a bill and voted to improve the wall, the current structure that's down there, right? The current border fence, and said that illegal immigration was a concern. So, I mean, this isn't something that was always a partisan issue. Today it is for some reason, but it's not really a large ask to say, let's enforce our border security, let's enforce our immigration laws, and let's really, you know, let's look at this pragmatically. I mean, to me, it's the folks who think that you shouldn't have borders, or that say that borders are somehow racist. I mean, to me, that doesn't make any sense. Every country in the world, despite what the majority ethnic or racial group is, they enforce some form of border security, from the strictest to, you know, some that are a little bit don't really have the resources to enforce it, but they still also, again, have the laws to enforce border security. So it's not a weird thing to ask.
Well, Senator, what's your thought on that? People that are already here that have been working hard, and there are a lot of people that are illegally here but living, you know, perfectly law-abiding lives. Is there a path there, you think, in the political climate?
I think that for Dreamers, in other words, kids that were born here, we should start there, you know, with a pathway toward ultimate citizenship. I think there'd be broad support for it, but it also needs to be combined with, you know, border security. I mean, look, if I were still in Congress, I'd be open to that kind of a compromise. I think that's a realistic place to go. But, you know, you've got an awful lot of people that, you know, just they don't want the wall. They don't want the Remain in Mexico policy. They want, you know, open borders and no border security, and then, you know, legalization for people that have crossed the border. I mean, you just, you know, you can't have that. So if there's a deal on immigration reform in Congress, and I would hope that there is one, that's where to start. Border security and the Dreamers, and then an immigration system that allows people to come into this country legally, okay, to fill the jobs that are needed to be filled, both skilled jobs and unskilled jobs, but in a way that doesn't depress people's wages that are here already. I mean, and so it's not that complicated, but it's highly partisan. And I think, you know, some people feel that by opening the borders, it's just going to create all these new voters, whether they're legal voters or illegal, they'd be illegal voters, but legal eventually, that are going to vote for one side, one political party. And actually, I don't think that would happen. But that, I think, is the view from, you know, the Biden administration as to why they've lost operational security on the border. And you're, you know, you're just seeing these pictures night after night after night. Now we have, you know, a border guard who lost his life trying to rescue two drug smugglers. I mean, go figure. This is outrageous.
Why do you think we're having such bigger problems on the southern border than we are on our border with Canada? Other than the fact, of course, that Mexico is
well,
more...
Well, you have to get into Canada first. I think that's the reason.
Ah, okay.
I think that's the reason. And it's a little harder to cross the northern border, I'm sure, than the southern border, although that can be pretty treacherous, too.
Yeah, I've heard that. I don't know. I've never really had any problems other than just very obnoxious Canadian border guards. I don't know. They seem to want an awful lot of information when you're going there. But that's just me. It is 12:27 here in WASR. We're talking with Senator Chip Bradley and with Representative Brody Deshays. Senator, how much time do you spend what I call constituent service, helping cut red tape and getting people in touch with resources that they can use?
Quite a bit of time. I think that when you're in the Senate, you do have staff that helps with these types of things. So I have a great person that works for me. Her name is Ava, and she is really good at trying to help resolve people's problems, whatever they may be. I get involved quite a bit of the time, trying to direct her as to who to go to. Sometimes I even have to pick up the phone myself and call, but I spend quite a bit of time on that. Yeah.
Brody, do you spend a lot of time on constituent service as well?
Of course. Yeah. I dedicate at least an hour every day replying to constituent requests. At least an hour every day, if not, maybe a little bit more. But yeah, I dedicate, having to reply to emails based on people who reach out just so they know that I read their email or, let them know about a specific issue if they're asking me how to vote on stuff. People making requests about where to find specific resources, people who contact me thinking I'm my father who serves on the Board of Selectmen about town issues. So, I mean, a whole host of stuff. I dedicate at least an hour every day. I mean, look, when you're a state representative, that's typically you're the closest to the people of your town, your community. And that's, in my opinion, that's your second most important duty. Most important duty is going and casting votes on behalf of your community. But the second thing is the constituent services, to be that liaison between the state government and bureaucracy and your town's governments, your local school, your local SAU, and your constituents, and helping them navigate what can sometimes be an absolute labyrinth. So I dedicate a lot of time. I pride myself. I always get back to everyone within 48 hours. Within 48 hours, I pride myself on any kind of request, any kind of email. If they live in the town of Wolfboro, and since they redistricted, now it's the town of Wolfboro and Tuftonboro. So if they live in Wolfboro or Tuftonboro, I am getting back to them within 48 hours. I'm trying to follow up with them. I am offering to take a call from them if they'd like to talk more about an issue or if the email, that they need to be walked through the email and the explanation of it. Senator Bradley's office is great to work with if I, am kind of confused about what a constituent is asking or if I need to be pointed in the right direction to help the constituent. Executive Counselor Joe Kenny has always been a
nice
huge
guy.
Help. He's always
nice
been a
guy.
Huge help, and he's someone who, I mean, he's really, his constituent service is top-notch. I mean, that's why I think he always gets back to the Executive Council, is it doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or Republican or an independent, his phone is, he's always available. Text, call, email, he's always going to help someone, doesn't matter who they are, doesn't matter if they voted for him. I mean, he told me a story once. Even despite when he lost his election in 2018, he didn't have any of the glory of being in office, but still had to assume all of the work. He still had businesses calling him when they were, having grand openings or for example, there was a bank that opened a new branch and they didn't even invite the incumbent executive counselor for District 1. They invited Joe Kenny still because they said, but you still do all the work. You still do everything. Everyone knows you. Right. So, I mean, that's the kind of constituent service I think every legislator should really be trying to emulate. And that's what I try to emulate every day is people understanding that it doesn't matter what party that they're from, that I'm there for them. I got my ear open, you know, two ears, one mouth. So that's why God made us that way. We listen twice as much as we speak. That's my goal.
Okay. Senator, what is the most common issue that you find with your constituents?
Probably roads, I would say. But, you know, immigration's a big issue. Of course, on that, I have to refer everybody to one of the federal delegation members. I just had somebody, for instance, who was supposed to fly to Europe on, you know, 2 days before they were going. They had misread their passport, realized that their passport had expired.
Uh-oh.
And that wasn't anything I could do, but I actually, you know, called one of the federal delegation members himself and, you know, spoke with him, spoke with his office, and I was able to get a passport. So, you know, it just, who knows what it might be, a lot of Medicaid issues, veterans issues certainly are important. It just, people reach out to us, you know, for help, and well, they should. During COVID, it was unemployment benefits. That was, you know, there were probably 200 or 300 people that, you know, I was able to work with and with the Department of Employment Security during the pandemic to make sure that they got, you know, what they were entitled to, because they were, you know, there were some issues in the online application process. Although I have to say the Department of Employment Security did a really great job of, you know, helping people then throughout that too.
What are some of the, let's look at it another way. The fact that you're able to help these people points to the fact that they weren't able to do it on with the existing structure. Does that data help improve service in some place? Like if you I'm hearing a lot about, for instance, the Department of Employment Security or whatever agency that's having a bureaucratic hiccup. Does that help you spot those?
Yeah, I think it does. I'm sure that, for instance, during the pandemic, the Department of Employment Security learned a lot about how to manage, you know, a huge influx of people that had lost their job and were applying for unemployment. And I think overall they did a great job. But like anything else, you know, we went from an unemployment rate of about 2.5% to, I think it was at its peak, 18%, and well over 100,000 people for a period of several months were unemployed. And it's just a huge influx to the system. I'm sure they learned an awful lot about how to manage that in the future. But, you know, I was able to connect people that were having trouble applying on how to do it and connect them with a human. Sometimes they hadn't answered every question. Sometimes they needed to provide, more information. So there were a lot of different, you know, things that we were able to help people with.
Okay. What's the best indication of our economic health? Is it the stock market, the unemployment rate, income, inflation?
I think all of them are really important. You know, I this is where I think New Hampshire's done it right, okay? These are some of the data points that I think are really important for our state. We have the lowest poverty rate in the country, okay? That's saying we're doing something right. We have among the lowest unemployment rates, among the highest per capita income. We're one of the safest states in the nation. And here's one that I think is really important. People are moving to New Hampshire, and we always rank consistently as one of the top three or four states on most desired states to live in. There are other indicators that, you know, most economic freedom, we rank very high. Opportunity, you know, for jobs, we rank very high. These are all things that point to the fact that we're doing a good job in New Hampshire. And I think that given what's happening in Washington with inflation at record highs, and just yesterday, gross domestic product, which is sort of the broadest indicator of, you know, the economic trends, dropped by 1.4%, is indicating that there could be trouble ahead. And even Deutsche Bank, one of the biggest banks in this country, you know, warned that we're not only just looking at a recession, but a major recession. So we're doing it right in New Hampshire. We've managed our budget well. We haven't overspent. We've made New Hampshire more competitive. We're generating huge surpluses of revenue that we're trying to use for one-time expenditures. We've done a lot to lower property taxes, and we continue to do that. And in fact, I think it's important to note that, you know, people's December tax bills will see the $100 million reduction in the statewide property tax. That's really good news for donor towns or possible donor towns like Wolfboro that actually get, you know, are going to get some relief. We've dedicated more revenue to towns and cities through the rooms and meals tax, $30 million of assistance to nursing homes, county nursing homes, that'll help county tax rates. My legislation is working its way through the House now that will dedicate $65 million to municipal road and bridge projects that that helps property taxpayers, you know, by putting state funds into these local projects to get the job done. We passed legislation that's over in the House now, 1221, that will help towns with 7.5% of their retirement costs, something that in the last Great Recession, Governor Lynch proposed getting rid of. And that's what happened. So now that we're running surpluses, you know, we're proposing to send some of that money, you know, back to cities and towns, which has been an agenda item for them. I'd like to think that we can continue to do that in the future if we're, you know, running the kind of surpluses that we're running now, or even, you know, anything approaching that. It's something we should do if we can afford to do it. But, you know, all of this comes from a good, strong economy. And, you know, for all my Democratic friends that moan that when we started lowering business taxes, you know, in 2015, that there were going to be holes in the budget, that we'd have, you know, huge revenue losses. Look what's happened. You know, we've collected almost $700 million more in revenue from business taxes than was expected over the last 7 or 8 years. And this budget, in particular, we're at a $250 million, you know, surplus. I'm not sure that's going to continue in the future, given that we may be staring a recession right in the face, but we've managed well. We've become more competitive. Businesses are trying to come here. Yes, we have to do something about affordable housing. That's one of the, you know, storm clouds, if you will, on the horizon, and something, you know, that I hope the House will vote for Senate Bill 400 next week in the way that, you know, is acceptable, at least. You know, so growing economy lifts all ships. And I think, you know, that I know it's been one of my priorities. I know it's a big priority for Brody and John McDonald, too.
Should we start thinking, at least as a state, about the possible upcoming recession? A lot of banks and a lot of places are ringing alarm bells.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's one thing to try to spend some of the surpluses that we have right now on, you know, tax relief, which is what we've done. But I think we also have to maintain a healthy balance in the rainy day fund in order to be a buffer if state revenues fall next year, which, you know, they could easily do. I think, you know, we're going to see good revenues again in April. I think this fiscal year we're all set, but, you know, who knows 6 months from now what the world's going to look like. And if we are starting to go back into a recession, you know, we're not going to have the same profitability of businesses that has driven, you know, the business tax revenue to be so strong. I mean, my Democratic friends love to, you know, raise taxes on businesses by calling them big out-of-state corporations. Sorry, you know, they employ New Hampshire people, and it's why we have that lowest poverty rating in the nation, you know, and high per capita income and low unemployment. And let's not, you know, let's not kick the golden goose, so to speak.
Okay. Brody, your thoughts on whether or not we're headed for the big R word.
A recession?
Yeah.
Well, with Biden in office and the Democrats controlling Congress, you can betcha, you know, they're not doing much to stop it. But, I mean, let's be real. You know, the reality is New Hampshire Republicans, you know, led by Governor Chris Sununu, Senator Jeb Bradley, Senate President Chuck Morris, they've created the economic opportunity that we need, that families need, to be able to have this surplus to make investments in our community. I mean, the House was happy to pass Senate Bill 401 that, you know, sent back $67 million worth of municipal aid, right? We passed the budget with $100 million in property tax relief. We made investments directly in our communities to increase the amount of revenue shared from the meals and rooms tax. I mean, as long as we're running these surpluses, you know, New Hampshire Republicans are going to keep investing in communities with grant dollars for one-time spending. So we're, one, not overcommitting ourselves and not overcommitting our future budgets so we can have fiscal solvency. And two, to decrease property taxes and to stimulate the kind of investments in infrastructure that helps the entire economy. And again, you know, every single budget that Republicans have decreased taxes in this state, right? Since Governor Chris Sununu took office and since prior to him taking office, we have seen record revenues every year after that. There's no surprise. I mean, when during COVID, New Hampshire had the lowest bankruptcy rate in a decade and the lowest bankruptcy rate in all of America, right? And when we've seen more businesses being opened in New Hampshire at any time in our state's history right now, you know, people see New Hampshire's competitive business climate and they're moving here and they're doing business and we're collecting revenues. And so what we're doing is when we decrease these business taxes, we're seeing more businesses open. We're seeing more, you know, more a larger pool of businesses that we're collecting taxes from. And they're all making great profits because the entire economy is stimulated. And when they're making great profits, the state's making great profits. When the state makes great profits, we're making great investments. We make those investments to further decrease taxes or to further improve local infrastructure. Well, the entire economy is getting stimulated. And so we got a great thing that we're doing here with the New Hampshire Advantage. We're holding the line, no income tax, no sales tax, no new taxes. We're phasing out the last income tax that New Hampshire has had, the interest and dividends tax, which disproportionately hurts retirees. You know, in Wolfboro has a lot of retirees. And so we're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep fighting. We're going to keep working hard. We're going to keep, you know, formulating great budgets, fiscally responsible, maximizing investments. I mean, that's been my goal as a legislator. And, you know, there are a lot of times where I see folks, you know, you can't just send any Republican down to Concord and think that they're going to be looking out for your back, that they're going to be looking out for your pocketbook, that they're going to be looking out for your community, right? Your community and the money that your community needs to make investments without overburdening people on a fixed income who disproportionately pay the property taxes, right? It takes a Republican to really put their ear to the ground and to listen to constituents. And, you know, time and time again, myself, Representative McDonald, Senator Jeb Bradley, you know, Governor Chris Sununu, we've done that, right? So you can't just jump 2 feet into this game and think that you're going to be as effective as effective as we've been in really working hard for our constituents.
Okay. Senator, your thought.
On?
Oh, I'm sorry. On probably help if I read the rest of the question. there looks like to be a pretty big Republican pickup. Do you think there'd be enough to have a veto-proof majority?
Well, I think, you know, with Governor Sununu, we don't need a veto-proof majority. But I think, you know,
Well, he does veto bills.
Yeah, and, you know, I work with Governor Sununu pretty carefully and closely, as does Brody. You know, there are always going to be a few things that we would disagree with the governor on, but I respect him and I respect his judgment. I'm not, you know, I would not want to be looking for, you know, the ability to override Governor Sununu's majorities, vetoes. I mean, what I would be looking for are good working majorities. And I hope that, you know, we're able to pick up, we're at 14 Republican senators. It would be nice to be at 15 or 16. And I think we have a chance at that. But, you know, we'll see how it plays out. I think there are huge differences between, you know, the parties right now. We've talked about some of the economic differences. You know, and I think an income tax is going to be on the ballot again this year because our friends on the other side of the aisle keep proposing things that will either spend us to an income tax or, you know, with their mandatory paid family leave that they had a couple of years ago, actually implement one. I think that's a big defining difference. I think, you know, how we manage our schools and giving, you know, parents that need some choice in education for their kids an opportunity to use their tax dollars, you know, to help educate their kids. That's another big difference. The rights of parents to know what, you know, is happening in their child's education in school. That's another big difference. You know, to say nothing of the differences that we're going to see on the national scene, which we've highlighted: inflation, potentially now a slowing economy. You know, the influx of illegals across the southern border, rising crime rates. You know, the debacle in Afghanistan. I mean, these are all things that I think are front and center on people's minds. And, you know, we'll see what happens. You can't take anything for granted. We're all going to have to go out and work hard. I know that, you know, Brody and John McDonald worked really hard for Wolfboro. You know, and all of us are going to have to, you know, go out this summer and fall and talk to voters and, you know, state our case, which is the way it should be.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with this with the senator. I mean, it's, you know, Eric, it's we all agree with the governor, right? And we're all working together, you know, especially, I mean, myself and the senator and Governor Chris Sununu, that, you know, we needed a comprehensive school choice program operated by the state to give everyone that kind of opportunity. Senator Bradley and I both voted for the Family and the Children's Bill of Rights that, you know, went through his Senate just recently, and we passed in the House that gives families more access to public education and more of a right to have a say in how their children are educated and, you know, what happens in schools and access to different information that, you know, schools, many school districts were already willing to give, but just making sure that every school district is doing that and letting parents get involved in a positive way. But I think even more, you know, you ask what a veto-proof majority for the governor, you don't need a veto-proof majority when you're a Republican like myself or Senator Bradley who are working with the governor. The real issue becomes, you know, that you can't just send down any old Republican, especially Republicans who are going to oppose Governor Chris Sununu or fight with the Senate. You know, I've prided myself on having a strong working relationship with our state senators and working with them even when there's disagreement, or with the governor and having the governor's back and having Senator Bradley's back. And, you know, people need to really take a good look at the candidates who are on the ballot, whether there's a primary or not, and really look at whether or not that person's going to work with the governor or if they're going to be fighting the governor and, you know, creating these circling firing squads that we don't want as Republicans, right? We need to have each other's backs. We need to understand that the governor is popular Over 60% of Granite Staters approve of the job that he's doing. 85% of New Hampshire Republicans support Governor Chris Sununu. I'm in his corner 100% always. I've been since he ran in the primaries in 2016. I supported him in 2018. I supported him in 2020. I'll support him again in 2022. The governor has done an amazing job, and we need Republicans who are willing to stand with him and understand to protect the New Hampshire Advantage, to protect our live for your die values. It takes working with Governor Chris Sununu, running with Senator Jeb Bradley, and working with, you know, all your colleagues who are Republicans, not just saying no, but finding out how we can get to yes.
Well, let's, on that subject, let's talk about one of the big Republican talking points, which is abortion. And there have been some victories for the anti-choice movement lately. I believe it was it Oklahoma, I believe, has now, or is it Kansas? I can't remember off the top of my head. But one state has literally criminalized abortion. In a state that's dedicated to freedom such as ours, Senator, should we be looking at that, especially if the Republican majority increases?
You know what? Look, I think we've gotten to a reasonable place. In the budget last year, we banned late-term abortion, abortion on demand right up until the moment of birth. And I think, you know, most voters in New Hampshire, that certainly I talk to, support that. There were a couple of issues in that bill that, because it was part of the budget, that we were unable to, you know, really fix. And I think we have fixed those by clarifying what is known as the ultrasound mandate, so that you only would need an ultrasound around that 24th week, which is, you know, generally the standard for viability. So the ultrasound mandate is now gone, okay? And there's also, they're just rare circumstances. They are rare, but they're real, that, you know, a baby will not be able to survive outside the womb. A fatal fetal anomaly. Not just a fetal anomaly, but a fatal fetal anomaly. So we created a very narrow exception from, you know, the 24-week ban for a fatal fetal anomaly. And so I think, you know, in the sort of the common sense way of New Hampshire, we tried to, you know, get a reasonable compromise on a very, very difficult issue. And, you know, I don't think in New Hampshire we're going to, you know, be proposing banning all abortions or a limit, you know, below 24 weeks. I just don't think that, you know, is where we're going to go. But banning late-term abortions, that's something I think virtually all New Hampshire people can agree to with the kind of provisions I just outlined.
Right. Brody?
I couldn't agree more with the governor and sorry, with the senator, but also, I mean, the governor too, who signed the original provisions that the senator describes and who supported, you know, these small carve-outs that we made for extremely ethically complex and, you know, extremely, you know, complicated situations where it's tough to have a one-size-fits-all government mandate. I'm not a big government guy. I know the senator and the governor, they're also not big government guys. And so, you know, we want to protect life. Like, I'm pro-life Republican. We want to protect life. We want to recognize that that's a living being, especially that late in a pregnancy. We want to prevent partial birth abortions, too. But we also want to understand in the case of like a fatal fetal anomaly where a child is not going to survive outside the womb, where there's a reality of twin diffusion syndrome, where one twin can be hurting the viability of another twin, and that twin that's hurting that other twin's viability is not going to survive the pregnancy, that to be able to protect life, there are specific medical procedures that need to be done. And New Hampshire's law didn't consider that. So, you know, working with the governor, we were able to fix that. We were able to get members of Republican leadership voted for this exception, and also understanding that New Hampshire Republicans are against medical mandates, right? And so the ultrasound kind of the transvaginal ultrasound mandate was way too broad and encompassing and violated people's medical freedoms. So we made sure that the ultrasound mandate was only for enforcing the 24-week pro-life abortion restrictions. And so we really have found, I think, a common sense solution to considering the life of the mother, considering very complex situations where medical procedures need to be done to protect the life of a fetus in a mother, and also considering the fact that we only need to find out viability, you know, to enforce this law from 24 weeks on. So we worked with the governor, we worked with the Senate, we worked as a Republican majority to find out, you know, again, just like with the bail reform, sometimes you do things and you realize that you miss some spots and you go back and you clean it up. That's part of legislating. And some folks will say that even allowing a basic exception like that is that's a bad thing. But I think overall, I think New Hampshire Republicans working together were able to create a better Fetal Life Protection Act, and pro-life Republicans like myself were able to really work, you know, with other Republicans who might not be as pro-life, but to really create the best results for Granite Staters. And, you know, I think that's important. I think that's why we go down to Concord every single week.
In our last couple of minutes, Senator, as we were talking about health care and the abortion issue, could the projected nationally, I'm talking about now, the Republican pickup endanger the Affordable Care Act? Or do you
No, I don't think so. I think at this point, you know, the Affordable Care Act is the law of the land. I think the insurance reforms, you know, were similar in the Affordable Care Act to things that we already had in New Hampshire. And it had, quite frankly, for a number of years. In other words, that you could not be turned away. You had guaranteed access to health insurance, or what's known as community rating, that there could be no cherry picking of favorable health risks, among people. So I think those things, you know, should stay. Certainly, I think Medicaid expansion has proven to be very beneficial to a whole array of people in New Hampshire. And I'm proud, you know, I was telling my wife this morning, of all the things that I've worked on over my years, it's probably the thing that is the most important. It's helped turn people's lives around. I think, though, that we need to, as a nation, address some of the root causes of the expensiveness and the expenses of health care. We need to focus more on preventative measures, on greater transparency of costs, so that people can comparison shop for services. These are things that, you know, the healthcare system is very complicated, and it's technologically getting more and more advanced every day, and that's expensive. I just had an MRI yesterday, and, you know, I'm sure the bill is going to be pretty high. Had to have it, but you know, the ability to be able to choose where you want to go based on price transparency will drive competition. And I think these are things that will help, you know, get healthcare costs under control. But much of that needs to happen on the federal basis. I mean, I think it'd be great if we could buy health insurance policies, you know, across state lines. That's a reform that needs to come, you know, from Washington. I think it would be great if especially businesses could aggregate more customers to get more volume buying power. That's a reform that needs to happen from Washington. That's why we need to send somebody like Chuck Morris, who's, you know, somebody that I've worked with in the Senate, down to Washington, because those are common sense solutions that, you know, are free market type solutions, but at the same time, you know, will drive down the cost of healthcare through competition. I think that's really important.
All right. We are unfortunately out of time. It is 1 o'clock. Senator, thank you very much again for your time, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Take care. Brody, thank you for coming in today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Eric. As always, it's wonderful, and I appreciate everyone back home listening.
1 o'clock. News is next.